How did she know where to tell us to look for this Jiki thing? It stood half-buried in the mud, about 12 cables south of where we first touched down. Judging from the portion that was visible from my vantage point way in back, it consisted of long spikes, each pointed outward in a different direction, as if aimed toward the 6 faces of a cube. Each spike had a big knob at the end, hollow, I guessed, to prevent sinking in the muck. It was obviously meant to be found, being colored a garish swirl of reds and blues. Red to really stand out at short range, since the color's almost totally absent underwater, and blue to be visible from farther away. If your beam happened to sweep across it in the deep darkness. Even so, you had to be within less than a cable to see the thing, so we'd never have come across it without Uriel's instructions. Still, it took 2 search spirals before we stumbled on the jack. It was the strangest thing any of us had ever encountered. And don't forget, I've heard a Gekek umble and witnessed a Treiki Vlen.
"Is it Boyer-Yur?"
Pinsir asked, superstitious awe invading his voice vents along with a return stammer.
"I bet a pile of donkey mulch that's not Boyer made,"
Huck said.
"What do you think, Uran?"
Our Urs pal stretched her neck past Pinsir, her muzzle drying a patch of the bubble window.
"No way the voyeur would have vilch anything so frightful ghastly," she agreed. "It's not their style." "Of course it's not their style," Huck continued. "But I know whose it is."
We all stared at her. Naturally, she milked the moment, pausing till we were on the verge of pummeling her.
"It's Urish," she concluded, with a tone of smug conviction.
"Urish," Pinsir hissed. "How can you be so?"
"Explain,"
Uran demanded, snaking her head to peer at Huck.
"This object is sophisticated. Uriel could forge nothing like it. Not even Earthlings have such craft." "Exactly. It's not Boyer, and no one currently living on the slope could make it. That leaves just one possibility. It must have been left here by an original Sooner starship when one of the 6 races, 7 if you include Glaivers, first arrived on Jijo, before the settlers scuttled their craft and joined the rest of us as primitives. But which one left it? I'd eliminate us Gekeks on account of we've been here so long that I'll bet the jack would have moved a lot farther into the rift by now. The same holds for Glaivers, Cowens, and Treiki. Anyway, the clincher is that Uriel knew exactly where to find it."
Fur riffled around the rim of Uran's nostril. Her voice turned colder than the surrounding ocean.
"You suggest a conspiracy?"
Gekek's stalks twined a shrug.
"Not a horribly vile one," Huck assured. Maybe just a sensible precaution. Think about it, mates. Say you've come to plant a sooner colony on a forbidden world. You must get rid of anything that it show on a casual scan by some institute surveyor, so your ship and complex gear have to go. Nearby space is no good. That's the first place cops a check. So you sink it amid all the stuff the Booyer dumped when they left Gijo. Sounds good so far. But then you ask yourself, what if an unforeseen emergency crops up? What if someday your descendants need something high-tech to help 'em survive?
Urron lowered her conical head. In the dimness, I could not tell if it denoted worry or rising anger. I hurried to cut in. Hrum, you imply a long view of things, a secret kept for generations.
For centuries, Huck agreed. Uriel no doubt was told by her master, and so on, back to the first Urish ancestors. And before Urron snaps one of my heads off, let me rush to add that the Ur's sages showed great restraint over the years, never seeking to use this cash during their wars with Kewins, then humans, even when they were getting their tails whipped.
That was meant to calm Urron? I rushed to save Huck from mutilation. Perhaps humans and Kewins had their own caches, so there was a standoff. Then my own words sank in. Maybe those caches are being sought now, while we serve as Uriel's dipping claw in search of this one. There was a long silence. Then Pincer spoke.
Sheesh. Those aliens up at the glade must really have the grown-ups spooked.
Another pause. Then Huck resumed.
That's what I'm hoping all of this is about. The aliens, a mutual effort of the six, pooling resources, and not something else.
Urron's neck twisted nervously.
What do you mean? I mean, I'd have liked Uriel's word of honor that we're down here seeking powers for the defense of all the commons.
Not simply to arm Urish militia in some of the grudge fights we've heard rumors about, I thought, finishing Huck's implication. There was a tense moment when I could not predict what would happen next. Had tension, worry, and Tugue's drugs strung our Urish friend to the point where Huck's baiting would make her snap? Urron's neck slowly untwisted, an effort of will I saw by the dim light of the phosphors.
You have, she began, breathing heavily. You have the oath of this Urs that it will be so.
And she repeated the vow in Galactic Two, following it with a laborious effort to spit on the floor,
Not an easy act for one of her kind. A sign of sincerity.
Hrm. Well, that's great, I said, umbling for peace. Not that any of us ever thought any different. Right, Huck? Pincer?
Both of them hurried to agree, and some of the tension passed. Underneath, however, seeds of worry had been laid. Huck, I thought, you'd bring a jar full of scorpions in a lifeboat, then drop it just to see who swims the best. We got underway again, and soon we were near enough to see how big the jack really was. Each of the bulbous balloon-like things at its spiky tips was larger than Wu Fan's dream.
"There's one of the cables Uriel talked about," Pincer announced, waving a claw toward one spike, from which a glossy black strand made a relatively straight line, though buried in places, aimed north in the direction we had come.
"I bet anything that line's broken somewhere tween here and the cliffs," Huck ventured. "Probably used to go all the way to some secret cleft or cave near Terminus Rock. From there, the cache might have been hauled in without an Urs ever having to get her hooves wet. That end point may have gotten cut in an avalanche or quake, like the one that killed my folks. This jack thing is a backup, so the cord can be picked up again, even if the first end point is lost."
Good thinking. It does explain one thing that had me puzzled. Why Uriel had so much equipment on hand, stuff that proved so useful for diving. In fact, it makes me wonder why she needed us at all. Why didn't she have a hidden bathy of her own in the first place? Urron was getting over her funk.
"A Gekek accountant inventories the forge warehouse regularly. He'd notice anything as un-Urish as a submarine just lying around ready to be used."
Her voice was sarcastic, yet Huck agreed.
"The difficult parts were there, the pumps and valves and gaskets. I'm sure Uriel and her predecessors figured they could whip up a hull and the rest in a matter of months. Whoever expected an emergency to strike so quick? Besides, we bunch of crazy kids offered a perfect cover story. No one will associate us with god caches from the galactic past."
"I prefer to think," Pincer interjected, with a dramatically miffed tone of voice, "that the real reason Uriel begged pretty please to be allowed to join our team was the superior design and craftsmanship of our ship-hip."
We quit bickering to stare at him for a moment. Then laughter filled the tiny cabin, making the hull vibrate and waking Hufu from her nap. The four of us felt better then, ready to get on with the mission. The hard part was over, it appeared. All we had to do now was order Ziz to attach a clamp to the cord on the jack's other side and signal Uriel to haul away. There would then be a long wait while we slowly rose up toward the surface, since Gekeks and Urs are even more likely than humans to get the bends if air pressure changes too rapidly. From books, we knew it's an awful way to die, so a tedious ascent was an accepted necessity. We had all packed snacks, as well as personal articles to help pass the time. Still, I was anxious to get on with it. Claustrophobia was nothing compared with the ordeal that would commence when everyone on board, each in his or her unique way, started feeling the need to go, as some earthling books politely put it, to the bathroom. There would be, it seemed, one slight difficulty in clamping on to the second cord. We saw the problem at once, upon rolling around to look at the jack's other side. The second cord was missing. Or rather, it had been cut. Fresh-looking metal fibers waved gently in the subsea currents, hanging like an unbraided Irish tail from one of the jack's spiky ends. Nor was that all. When Euron cast our beams across the ocean floor, we saw a wavy trail in the mud, meandering south, in which direction the cord apparently had been dragged. None of us knew how to tell if this was done days or jadurs or years ago, but the word recent came to mind. No one had to say it aloud. Electric sparks flashed as Euron reported the situation to those waiting in the world of air and light. Surprise was evident in the long delay. Then an answer came back down, crackling pulses across the tiny spark gap. If in good health, follow trail for two cables, then report. Huck muttered,
"As if we've got any choice with a reel controlling the winch. Like a little case of narcosis or the cramp jitters would make a difference to her."
This time Euron didn't turn around, but both tails switched Huck's torso sharply just below the neckline.
"Ahead one half, Alvin," Pincer commanded.
With a sigh, I bent over to begin again. So we set forth, keeping one beam focused on the snake trail through the mud, while Euron cast the other searchlight left and right, up and down. Not that seeing a threat in advance would give us any kind of useful warning. There was never a vessel as unarmed, slow, and helpless as Wufan's Dream. That severed cord we had seen. It had been made by beings using galactic technology, intended to survive millennia underwater and still retain immense strength. Whatever had sliced it apart wasn't anything I wanted to make angry. A deeper, more solemn mood filled the cabin as we crept onward. After cranking for more than a midura against the ever-changing traction of slippery muck, my arms and back were starting to feel the stinging tingle of second-stage fatigue. I was too tired to umble. Behind me, Hufu expressed her boredom by rummaging through my backpack, tearing open a package of pish-fish sandwiches, nibbling part of it, and scattering the rest through the bilge. Splashing noises and a wet tickling on my toe pads told of water accumulating down there, whether from excess humidity or some slow leak or our own disgusting wastes, I didn't care to guess. The aroma inside was starting to get both complex and pretty damn ripe. I was fighting another onset of confinement dread when Pincer let out a shrill yell.
"Alvin, stop! Back up! I mean, engines back full!"
I wish I could report that I saw what caused this outburst, but my view was blocked by frenzied silhouettes. Besides, I had my hands full finding the momentum of the crank, which seemed determined to keep turning in the same direction despite me driving the wheels ever forward. I held the wooden rods in a strangle grip and heaved with all my might, feeling something pop in my spine. Finally, I managed to slow the axles, then, at last, bring them to a stop. But for all my grunting effort, I could not make them turn the other way.
"I'm getting a list," Huck announced. "Tilting forward and to port."
"I didn't see it coming," Pinsir cried out. "We were climbing a little hill, then it just came out of nowhere, I swear."
Now I could feel the tilt. The Dream was definitely tipping forward, even as Huck frantically pumped ballast aft. The Ike beams seemed to flail around the darkness up ahead, offering an unsettling view of yawning emptiness, where before there had been a gently sloping plain. I finally managed to get the crank turning backward, but any sense of victory was short-lived. One of the magnetic clutches, attached to a wheel salvaged from Huck's aunt, I believe, gave way. The remaining roller bit hard into the mud, with the effect of abruptly slewing us sideways. The beams now swung along the lip of the precipice we were poised upon. Apparently, what we had thought was the main floor of the rift had been but a shelf along the outskirts of the actual trench. The true gash now gaped, ready to receive us, as it had received so many other things that would never again partake in affairs up where stars glittered bright. So many dead things. And we were about to join them.
"Shall I cut ballast?" Huck asked frantically. "I can cut ballast. Pull the signal cord to have Ziz inflate. I can do it. Shall I do it?"
I reached out and took two eye stalks, gently stroking them in the calming way I had learned over the years. She wasn't making any sense. The weight of all the steel hawser we trailed was greater than a few bricks slung under the belly of Wufan's Dream. If we cut the hawser, too, we might rise all right, but then what would keep the air hose from tangling and snapping as we spun and tumbled? Even if it miraculously survived, unsnarled, we would shoot up like the bullet ship in Verne's First Men in the Moon. Even Pinsir would probably die of the bends. More practical, with death looming before us, Euron fired off rapid spark pulses, telling Uriel to yank us home without delay. Good idea, but how long would it take, I wondered, for the crew above to haul in all the slack? How fast could they do it without risking a crimp in the air hose? How far might we fall before two opposite pulls met in a sudden jerk? The moment of truth would be when we discovered just how well we'd built the Dream. Helplessly, I felt the wheels lose contact with the muddy shelf as our brave little bathy slid over the edge, starting a long, languid fall into darkness. That, I guess, would be a nice dramatic place to end a chapter, with our heroes tumbling into the black depths. A true-to-life cliffhanger. Will the crew ever make it home again? Will they survive? Yeah, that'd make a good stopping point. What's more, I'm tired and hurting. I need to call for help, so I can make it to the bucket in the corner of this dank place and get some relief. But I won't stop there. I know a better place, just a bit farther down the stream of time. As Wufan's Dream slowly fell, rotating round and round, and we watched the Ike beams sweep a cliff face that rose beside us like the wall of an endless tomb. Our tomb. We dropped half of our ballast, which helped slow the plunge, till a current yanked a hold of the Dream, dragging us faster. We dropped the remainder, but knew our sole chance lay in Uriel reacting perfectly, and then 100 other things working better than there was any hope of them working. Each of us was coming to terms with death in our own way, alone, facing the approaching end of our personal drama. I missed my parents. I mourned along with them, for my loss was in many ways as bitter to me as it would be to them, though I wouldn't have to endure for years the sorrow they'd carry, on account of my foolish need for adventure. I stroked and umbled Hufu, while Uron whistled a plains lament, and Huck drew all four eyes together, looking inward, I supposed, at her life. Then out of nowhere, Pincer shouted a single word that overrode the keening of our fears, a word we had heard from his vents before, too many times, but never quite like this, never with such tones of awe and wonder.
"Monsters! Urs! Urs!" he yelled.
Then with rising terror and joy, he cried it out again.
"Monsters!"
No one has come to answer my call. I'm stuck lying here with a back that won't bend and a terrible need for that bucket. My pencil is worn down and I'm almost out of paper, so while I'm waiting, I might as well push on to the real dramatic moment of our fall. All was confusion inside Wufan's dream as we plunged toward our doom. We tumbled left and right, banging against the inner hull, against cranks, handles, levers, and each other. The view outside, when I could see past my wildly gesturing comrades, was a jumbled confusion of phosphorescent dots caught in the Ike beams, plus occasional glimpses of a rising cliff face, and then quick flashes of something else. Something, or some things, lustrous and gray, agile flitting movements, then curious strokings rubbing our vessel's hull, followed by sharp raps and bangs all along the flanks of our doomed boat. Pincer kept babbling about monsters. I honestly thought he'd gone crazy. But Uron and Huck had changed their wailing cries and were leaning toward the glass as if transfixed by what they saw. It was also noisy, and Hufu was clawing my aching backside between frenzied attacks on the walls. I felt sure I made out Huck saying something like,
"What or who could they possibly be?"
And that's when the whirling shapes divided, vanishing to both sides, as a new entity arrived, causing us all to gasp. It was huge, many times the size of our bathy, and it swam with easy grace, emitting a growl as it came. From my agonizing prison at the back, I could not make out much except two great eyes that seemed to shine far brighter than our failing Ike beams. And its mouth? I recall seeing that all too well, as it spread wide, rushing to meet us. The hull groaned, and there were more sharp bangs. Uron yelped as a needle spray of water jetted inward, ricocheting back at me. Numb with fear, I could not stop my whirling brain long enough to have a single clear thought, only a storm of notions. These were Booyer ghosts, I guessed, come to punish living fools who dared invade their realm. They were machines, cobbled together from relics and remnants that had tumbled into the rift since long before the Booyer, in epics so old even the Galactics no longer recalled. They were homegrown sea monsters, Jijo's own, products of the world's most private place. These and other fancies flashed through my muddled brain as I watched, unable to look away from those terrible onrushing jaws. The dream buffeted and bucked in sea currents, I now suppose, but at the time it felt she was struggling to get away. The jaws swept around us. A sudden surge brought us hurtling to one side. We hit the interior of the great beast's mouth, crashing with such force that the beautiful glass bubble cracked. Frosted patterns spread from the point of impact.
Euron wailed, and Huck rolled her eye stalks tight like socks going in a drawer. I grabbed Hufu, ignoring her tearing claws, and took a deep breath of stale air. It was awful stuff, but I figured it would be my last chance. The window gave up at the same moment the air hose snapped. The dark waters of the rift found their rapid way into our shattered ship. Part 24. The Book of the Slope. Legends. It took 20 years to recover the first human band of Sooners, a sizable group who fled to the scrublands south of the Vale, rejecting the covenant of exile that their leaders had signed just before the Tabernacle went tumbling to the depths. They risked both desolation and the law in order to get away, and had to be dragged back, shuddering in dread, all because they could not bring themselves to trust Hoon or Treiki. In retrospect, this seems so ironic, since it was the Kewans and Urs who caused human settlers grief during 2 subsequent centuries of war. Why then did so many Earthlings fear the peaceful ringed ones, or our cheerful friends with the broad shoulders and booming voices? The star cousins of both Treiki and Hoon must have seemed quite different when our ancestors' first starships emerged onto the lanes of Galaxy 4. Unfortunately, most galactology records burned in the Great Fire, but other accounts tell of relentless hostility by mighty, enigmatic star lords calling themselves Jofer, who took a leading role in the sequestration of the Mudaun. That fearsome atrocity led directly to the Tabernacle Exodus, an outrage executed with single-minded precision and utter resoluteness. Traits not often observed in Treiki here on the slope. It is also said that Hoon were at Mudaun, portrayed in the accounts as doer, officious, unhappy beings. A race of stern accountants dedicated to population control and tabulating the breeding rates of other races, unswayed by appeals to mercy or forbearance. Could anyone recognize, in these descriptions, the 2 most easygoing members of the 6? No wonder Hoon and Treiki seemed the least prone to nostalgia about good old days, back when they flew about as gods of space. Annals of the Jijoan Commons. Sarah. With dawn bleaching the eastern sky, weary travelers trudged into Oryuta's oasis after a long night march across the parched Warrel Plain, a teeming, thirsty crowd of donkeys and Simlas, humans and Hoon. Even Urish pilgrims stepped daintily to the muddy shore and dipped their narrow heads, wincing at the bitter, unmasked taste of plain water. Full summer had broken over the high steppe, when hot winds ignited rings of circle grass, sending herds stampeding amid clouds of dust. Even before the present crisis, wayfarers avoided the summer sun, preferring the cool moonlight for travel. Urish guides bragged they would know the plain blindfolded. "That's fine for them," Sarah thought, swishing her aching feet in the oasis spring. "And Urs doesn't fall on her face when a chance stone turns underfoot. Me, I like to see where I'm going." Pre-dawn light revealed mighty outlines to the east. "The Rimmers," Sarah thought. The mixed-race expedition was making good time, hurrying to reach the glade before events there reached a climax. On the plus side, she was anxious to see her brothers and to learn how well Bloor was implementing her idea. There might also be medical help for her ward, the stranger,
if it seemed safe to reveal him to the aliens. A big if. Nor has she quite given up on getting to see one of the fabled library consoles of the great galactics. Yet there was also much to fear. If the star gods did plan on wiping out all witnesses, it would surely start at the glade. Above all, Sarah worried that she might be taking the stranger into the hands of his enemies. The dark, ever-cheerful man seemed eager to go, but did he really understand what was involved? A whistling sigh fluted from Pizora's corrugated cone, as the Traiki siphoned water from the pond, fatigued despite having ridden all the way in a donkey-drawn chariot. A new rauk draped across Pizora's sensor ring, one of two Sarah had bought from the fresh supply at Candu Landing, to help the Traiki pharmacist treat the wounded alien, even though she wasn't keen on the symbionts herself. A chain of bubbles broke the surface near Sarah's foot. By loosened silver light, she made out Blade from Dolo Village resting under water. The hasty trek had been hard on red Kellens and blues like Blade, as well as those humans too big to burden a donkey. Sarah had been allowed to mount every even-numbered Midura. Even so, her body ached. "Serves me right for leading a bookish, cloistered life," she thought. A raucous cheer rose up where Urish donkey drivers piled grass and dung to make a campfire. Simla blood was drained into a tureen, followed by chopped meat, and soon they were slurping tepid, sanguinary stew, lifting their long necks to swallow, then bending for more, sinuous silhouettes whose rise and fall was eerily accompanied by the stranger's plinking dulcimer. Meanwhile, a hoon cook, proud of her multi-race cuisine, banged pots and sprinkled powders until spicy aromas finally overcame the stench of roast simla, restoring even Sarah's queasy appetite. A little while later, full dawn revealed stunning tan and green mountains towering across the eastern horizon. The stranger laughed as he worked, shirtless, helping Sarah and the other humans do a typical camp chore assigned to Earthlings, erecting shelters of Gekek blur cloth to shade travelers and beasts through the blazing day. The Starman's muteness seemed no handicap at working with others. His pleasure at being alive affected all those around him, as he taught the others a wordless song to help pass the time. 2 more days, Sarah thought, glancing up toward the pass. We're almost there. The oasis was named for a nomad warrior who had lived soon after Urish settlement on Jijo, when their numbers were still small and their planet-bound crafts pitifully crude. In those olden times, Eruda fled east from the rich grazing lands of Znunir, where her tribal chiefs had vowed fealty to the mighty Grey Queens. Eruda led her fellow rebels to this wadi in the vast dry plain to nurse their wounds and plot a struggle for freedom from Kellen dominance. Or so went the legend Sarah heard that afternoon, after sleeping through the hottest part of the day, a slumber during which she had dreamed vaguely of water, cool and clear, raising a terrible thirst. She slaked it at the spring, then rejoined the other travelers under the big tent for another meal. With a few hours still to go before dusk, and a leaden heat still pressing outside, tinkers and pack handlers gathered around a storyteller, accompanying her recital with foot stamps and switched braided tails. Even after gaining books and printing, Urs still loved the oral tradition, its extravagance and impromptu variations. When the bard's chant reached the Battle of Snunir trading post, elongated heads swayed together. Triplet eyes stared past the poet toward times gone by. So the traitor cavalry scattered, willing slaves the cowards were driven, into the trap Uruta had fashioned, tumbling, screaming through deep stink crevasse, there to mix sulphurous death smells with their own dry pouch, death-fearing rankness. Listeners hissed contempt for gutless renegades. Sarah pulled out her notebook and took notes on the antiquated storytelling dialect, already devolved from Gal II, long before humans came. Then wheeled Uruta, ready to confront the dread footmen of gray Cowan matrons, males in armor, males with weapons of sharp-edged hardwood, flashing so brightly, and clattering claws keen to tear hide, poised now to flay us in shreds for their mothers. This time the Ur's listeners vented repeated low grunts, marking respect for a tough foe, a sound humans first heard the third generation after arriving, when Earthlings won their own place in the pre-commons chaos. "Now is the time, our chief gives the signal. Bring forth the weapons, tools newly fashioned. Bring forth the long sticks. Come forth, you strongbacks. Stab now to miss, but stab hard below. Bear now the burden, bear it, you strongbacks. Heave, claws of flashing, over they go." At first Sarah had trouble following the action. Then she understood Uruta's combat innovation, using long sticks, or rods of boo, to tip over the invincible Cowan infantry. Urish volunteers served as living fulcrums, braving snapping claws and crushing weight, while their fellows heaved, toppling one Cowan after another. Despite the ecstatic song of vengeful slaughter, Sarah knew the historical Uruta's victories had been short-lived, as Cowans adjusted their tactics. It took a later breed of heroes, the warrior Smiths of Blaze Mountain, to finally drive gray tyrants off the high plains. And still the queens thwarted the rising commons until humans brought new old skills to the art of war. Not all the Urs were celebrating past glories. The caravan chief and her aides knelt on a Peco skin rug, planning the next trek. From their gestures over a map, they clearly meant to skip the next oasis and make a hard dash for the foothills by sunrise. "Oh, my aching feet," Sarah thought. The chief raised her conical head, hissing as one human pilgrim neared a tent flap.
"Gotta go," explained Jop, the Dolo tree farmer.
"What, leaking again? Are you ill?"
Jop had spent most of the journey immersed in a copy of the Scroll of Exile, but now he seemed affable. He laughed.
"Oh, no. I just drank too much lovely spring water. Time to give it back to Gijo, that's all."
While the flap was briefly up, Sarah glimpsed bubbles in the pond again. Blade was back under, soaking for the next hard march. Was he also blocking out the storyteller's victory paean over defeated Cowans? The flap fell, and Sarah looked around the pavilion shelter. Kurt the Exploser used a compass to draw loopy arcs on sheets of graph paper, growling over his labors, making a papermaker's daughter wince as he crumpled one sheet after another in frustration. Nearer to Sarah, Pretty also drew abstract figures, more economically, in a patch of sand. Pulling at her furry chin, she consulted a topology text Sarah had brought from Byblos.
"My, what an intellectual caravan," Sarah observed sardonically. "A would-be priest, a designer of things that go bang, a geometrical chimpanzee, and a fallen mathematician, all hurrying toward possible destruction. And that just begins our list of oddities."
Over to the left, the stranger had set aside his dulcimer to watch Kurt's nephew, young Joma, play a game of Tower of Haiphong with a red Kewan salt peddler, a pair of Byblos librarians, and three Hoonish pilgrims. The contest involved moving colored rings over a hexagonal array of posts stuck in the sand. The goal was to pile a stack of rings on your home post in the right order, largest at the bottom, smallest on top. In the advanced game, where ring colors and patterns signified treiki attributes, one must wed various traits to form an ideal treiki. Pizora seemed more entranced by the storyteller than the game. Sarah had never heard of a treiki taking offense at Tower of Haiphong, even though it mimicked their unique mode of reproduction.
"See here," the boy explained the game to the stranger. "So far I got swamp flippers, a mulching core, two memory rings, a sniffer, a thinker, and a looker."
The star human showed no sign of frustration by Joma's rapid speech. He watched the apprentice exploser with an expression of intelligent interest. Perhaps he heard Joma's warbling voice as something like musical notes.
"I'm hoping for a better base to let my treiki move around on land. But Horm Tuwoa snatched a walker Taurus I had my eye on, so it looks like I'm stuck with flippers."
The hoon to the boy's left crooned a low umble of gratification. You had to think fast playing Tower of Haiphong.
"Build me a dream house, oh my dear, 14 stories high. Basement, kitchen, bedroom, bath, I love you till I die."
Joma and the others all stopped what they were doing to stare at the stranger, who rocked back and laughed. "He's getting better at this," Sarah thought. Still, it seemed eerie whenever the starman came up with the verse to some song, perfectly apropos to what was going on at the time. With a glitter in his eye, the stranger waited till the other players were engrossed once more in their own stacks. Then he nudged Joma, covertly pointing out a game piece ready to draw from the reserve box. The boy stared at the rare Taurus called Runner, trying so hard to stifle a yelp of joy that he coughed while the dark alien patted him on the back.
Now how did he know that? Do they play Tower of Haiphong among the stars?
She had pictured space gods doing, well, godlike things. It was encouraging to think they might use games with simple pieces, hard, durable symbols of life.
"Of course, most games are based on their being winners and losers."
The audience hissed appreciatively as the bard finished her epic and left the low platform to accept her reward, a steaming cup of blood.
"Too bad I missed the end," Sarah thought.
But she would likely hear it again if the world lasted beyond this year. When no one else seemed about to take the stage, several Urs stretched and started drifting toward the nearest tent flap, to go outside and check their animals, preparing for tonight's trek. But they stopped when a fresh volunteer abruptly leaped up, clattering hooves on the dais. The new storyteller was Ulgor, the tinker, who had accompanied Sarah ever since the night the aliens passed above Dolo Village.
Listeners regathered around as Ulgor commenced reciting her tale in a dialect even older than the one before.
Ships fill your thoughts right now, fierce, roaming, silently. Ships fill your dreams right now, far from all, watery seas. Ships cloud your mindscape now, numberless hordes of them. Ships dwarf your mindscape now, than mountains vaster far.
A mutter of consternation. The caravan chief corkscrewed her long neck. This was a rare topic, widely thought in poor taste among mixed races. Several Hoonish pilgrims turned to watch.
Ships of the Urish Ka, clan of strong reverence, ships of the Urish host, clan bound for vengeance.
Bad taste or no, a tale underway was sacrosanct till complete. The commander flared her nostril to show she had no part in this breach, while Ulgor went on evoking an era long before Ur's colonists ever set hoof on Jijo. To a time of space armadas, when god fleets fought over incomprehensible doctrines, using weapons of unthinkable power.
Stars fill your thoughts right now. Ships large as mountain peaks, setting stars quivering, with planet-sized lightings.
Sarah wondered, why is she doing this? Ulgor had always been tactful for a young Urz. Now she seemed out to provoke a reaction. Hoon sauntered closer, air sacs puffing, still more curious than angry. It wasn't yet clear that Ulgor meant to dredge up archaic vendettas, grudges so old they made later Jijo-based quarrels with Kewans and men seem like tiffs over this morning's breakfast. On Jijo, Urz and Hoon share no habitats and few desires, no basis for conflict. It's hard to picture their ancestors slaughtering each other in space. Even the Tower of Haifong game was abandoned. The stranger watched Ulgor's undulating neck movements, keeping tempo with his right hand.
O ye native listeners, so smugly ignorant, planet-bound minds, dare you try to conceive of planet-like holes in space in which dwell entities that planet-bound minds like yours cannot perceive?
Several Hoon humbled relief. Perhaps this wasn't about archaic struggles between their forebears and the Urz. Some space epics told of awesome vistas, or sights baffling to modern listeners, reminders of what the Six had lost, but might regain someday, ironically by forgetting.
Cast back your dread-filled thoughts to those ships frigidly cruising toward glory's gate, knowing not destiny.
If the first bard had been ardent, chanting bloody glory, Ulgor was coolly charismatic, entrancing listeners with her bobbing head and sing-song whistle, evoking pure essences of color, frost, and fear. Sarah put her notebook down, spellbound by vistas of glare and shadow, by vast reaches of space-time, and shining vessels more numerous than stars. No doubt the yarn had grown in retelling countless times. Even so, it filled Sarah's heart with sudden jealousy. "We humans never climbed so high before our fall. Even at our greatest, we never possessed fleets of mighty starships. We were wolflings, crude by comparison." But that thought slipped away as Ulgor spun her rhythmic chant, drawing out glimpses of infinity. A portrait took shape of a great armada bound for glorious war, which fate lured near a dark region of space. A niche, mysterious and deadly, like the bitter hollows of a mulk spider's lair. A place wise travelers skirted, but not the admiral of this fleet. Steeped in her own invincibility, she plotted a course to fall on her foes, dismissing all thought of detour.
"Now from one black kernel spirals out fortune's bane, casting its trap across throngs of uneasy stars."
With a sudden jerk, Sarah's attention was yanked back to the present by a hard tug on her right arm. She blinked. Pretty gripped her elbow, tight enough to grow painful, until Sarah asked, "What is it?" Letting go, her chim consort signed, "Listen. Now." Sarah was about to complain. "That's what I was doing, listening." Then realized Pretty did not mean the story, so she tried to sift past Ulgor's mesmerizing drone and finally picked up a low mutter coming from outside the pavilion. "The animals. Something's upsetting them." The Simlas and donkeys had their own camouflaged shelter a short distance away. Judging from a slowly rising murmur, the beasts weren't exactly frightened, but they weren't happy either. The stranger also noticed, along with a couple of librarians and a red cowan, all of them backing away, looking around nervously. By now, the caravan chief had joined the crowd of rising, falling Urish heads, lost in a distant place and time. Sarah moved forward to nudge the expedition leader, carefully, since startled Urs were known to snap. But all at once, the chief's neck went rigid of its own accord, anxious tremors rippling her tawny mane. With a hiss, the Urs matron roused two assistants, yanking a third back to reality with a sharp nip to the flank. All four stood and began trotting toward the tent flap, then skittered to a halt as phantom shapes began rising along the shelter's western edge, shadowy centauroid outlines, creeping stealthily, bearing spiky tools. A dismayed screech escaped one of the caravan lieutenants just before chaos exploded on all sides. The audience burst into confusion. Grunts and whistling cries spilled from stunned pilgrims as the tent was ripped in a dozen places by flashing blades. War-painted fighters stepped through the gaps, leveling swords, pikes, and arbalests, all tipped with bronze-colored buoyer metal, driving the churn mass of frightened travelers back toward the ash pit at the center. Pretty's arms clasped Sarah's waist, while young Joma clung to her side. She wrapped an arm around the boy for whatever comfort it might offer. "Urish militia?" she wondered. These warriors looked nothing like the dun-colored cavalry that performed showy maneuvers for landing day festivals. Slashes of sooty color streaked their flanks and withers. Their weaving, nodding heads conveyed crazed resolve. A caravan lieutenant bolted toward the stand where weapons were kept, mostly to ward off liggers, kubras, or the occasional small band of thieves. The trail boss shouted in vain as the young Urs dove for a loaded arbalest and kept going, toppling through the stand and skidding along a trail of sizzling blood. She tumbled to a stop, riddled with darts, at the feet of a painted raider. The expedition leader cursed the intruders, deriding their courage, their ancestry, and especially her own complacency. Despite rumors about trouble in far corners of the plains, peacetime habits were hard to break, especially along the main trail. Now her brave young colleague had paid the price.
"What do you want?" she demanded in Gal, too. "Do you have a leader? Show her criminal muzzle if she dares to speak."
The tent flap nearest the oasis lifted, and a burly Urish warrior entered, painted in jagged patterns that made it hard to grasp her outline. The raider chieftain high-stepped delicately over the lieutenant's bloody trail, cantering to a halt just before the caravan commander. Surprisingly, both of her brood pouches were full, one with a husband whose slim head peered under the fighter's arm. The other pouch was blue and milk-veined, bulging with unfledged offspring. A full matron was not usually prone to violence, unless driven by duty or need.
"You are not one to judge our praiseworthy daring," the raider captain hissed in an old-fashioned, stilted dialect. "You who serve unworthy client masters with too many or too few legs, you are not fit to valuate this band of sisters. Your sole choice is to submit obsequiously according to the much-revered code of the plains."
The caravan chief stared with all three eyes.
"Code? Surely you do not mean the archaic, irrelevant rituals that old-time barbaric tribes used back when the code of war and faith among noble, true-to-their-nature tribes confirmed the way of our much-revered aunts going back generations before recent despicable corruption set in, confirmed. Once again, I ask, demand, do you submit?"
Confused and alarmed, the caravan chief shook her head human-style, blowing air uncertainly like a hoon. With a low aspiration, she muttered in Anglic,
"Brr! Such cheeky nonsense for a grown-up adult to kill over."
The raiders sprang upon the merchant trader, wrapping their necks, shoving and twining forelegs, till the caravan chief toppled with a groan of agony, wheezing in shock. Any earthly vertebrate might have had her spine snapped. The raider turned to the pilgrims, with her head stretched far forward as if to snap anyone in reach. Frightened prisoners pressed close together. Sarah tightened her grip on Joma, pushing the boy behind her.
"Again, I ask, demand, who will unreservedly submit in the name of this miserable excuse for a tribe?"
Adura passed. Then out of the circle staggered a surviving lieutenant, perhaps pushed from behind. Her neck coiled tightly, and her single nostril flared with dread as she stumbled toward the painted harlequin. Trembling, the young Urs crouched and slowly pushed her head along the ground till it rested between the raider's forehooves.
"Well done," the corsair commented. "We shall make a barely acceptable plainsman of you. As for the rest, I am called Urkachu. In recent foolish days, I was known as Lord High Aunt of Salty Hoof Clan, a useless honorary title bereft of real power or glory. Now banished from that ungrateful band, I co-lead this new company of cousin comrades. United, we resurrect one of the great lamented warrior societies, the Uruntai."
The other raiders raised their weapons, bellowing a piercing cry. Sarah blinked surprise. Few humans grew up ignorant of that name, fearsome from bygone days.
This we have done because so-called aunts and sages have betrayed our glory race, falling into a reviled human trap, a scheme of extermination planned by alien criminals.
From an abstract corner of her mind, Sarah noted that the raider was losing control over her tailored, old-fashioned Gal 2 phrasing, giving way to more modern tones, even allowing bits of hated Anglic to slip in. The other raiders hissed supportive counterpoint to their leader's sing-song phrasings. Orkachu leveled her head toward the pilgrims, twisting and searching, then stopped before a tall, dark, human male. The stranger.
"Is this he, the star demon?"
The spaceman smiled back, as if not even bloody murder could break his good humor. This, in turn, seemed to set the painted Urs back momentarily.
"Is this the selected sought-after one?" Urkachu went on. "Sky cousin to those two-legged devils we have lived among for long-suffering generations?"
As if trying to perceive a new form of life, the crippled star alien flipped the veil of his new rauk over his eyes, then off again, comparing perspectives on the Urish marauder. Perhaps with meaning robbed from words, he found some in the riot of emotion-laden colors. A new voice spoke up, as smooth and coolly magnetic as the warrior chief was fiery fierce, answering from behind the mass of huddled pilgrims.
"This is the one,"
Algor assured, emerging from the tight-packed, sweaty crowd, stepping toward Urkachu. Like the stranger, she showed no trace of fear.
"It is the promised prize recovered from far-off Dolo Town, recently confirmed by a human sage to be one of the star demons, not Jijo born."
While the pilgrims muttered dismay at Algor's betrayal, Urkachu's hooves clattered joy.
"Those from space will pay dearly for his return. For this they may offer one thing valuable above all else, survival for some, though not all, Urs on Jijo."
Many things suddenly made sense. The motive for this raid, as well as Ulgor's spellbinding performance on the storytelling platform, designed to keep the caravan crew inside while the Urantai moved stealthily into position. A slim shadow fell between the two Urish leaders. A new voice cut in, speaking Anglic.
"Don't forget, friends, we'll be demanding a bit more than just that."
A human form stood in the torn entry. Moving away from the late afternoon glare, it resolved as Jop, the Dolo village tree farmer.
"There's a whole list of things we'll be needin' if they're to get their boy back hale and whole."
Jop glanced at the stranger's scarred scalp.
"Or as whole as the poor veg will ever be."
Sarah realized. He went outside to signal the raiders, while Ulgor kept us distracted. A strange alliance, a human purist helping Urish fanatics who named their group after the ancient earthling-hating Urantai society. A frail alliance, if Sarah overheard rightly when Urkachu muttered sideways to Ulgor,
"Would things not prove simpler without this one?"
Tellingly, the painted warrior winced and shut up when Ulgor gave her leg a sharp kick out of view of the other Urs. Sarah detached Joma and Pretty, sheltering them in the crowd before taking a step forward. "You can't do this," she said. Jop's smile was grim.
"And why not, little bookworm?"
It was a victory to keep a tremor out of her voice.
"Because he may not be one of the gene thieves at all. I have reason to believe he may actually be an enemy of theirs."
Ulgor looked the stranger up and down, nodding.
"A possibility that matters not at all. What counts is we have goods to sell and can set a price."
That price Sarah could envision. For Urkachu, a return to glory days of wild warriors roaming free. Not incompatible with Jop's goal to have all the damn